Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Carol.
And here we are with another special program on this strange and wonderful world. It's kind of the end of a series of programs, which we hope by the time you're hearing this will be archived. I'm sure they will, and you'll be able to go to KLOI.org and choose which one you want to hear. This is number 8 in a series. And what are we going to talk about today? We're going to move a little bit north. I know that part.
Right. Well, we've left Antarctica proper after 7 sessions down there. And I want to talk about the people who lived the closest to Antarctica. They didn't live in Antarctica itself, but they lived the closest. And they're interesting people in and of themselves, and particularly interesting for reasons which I'll elaborate, having to do with none other than Charles Darwin.
All right. I look forward to that. And as you say, with the coming of spring here, late spring or early spring, I guess it depends on how you look at it, it's time to move to warmer climates.
Absolutely, although the place we're moving to is not terribly warm.
Okay, well, okay. I look forward to hearing. And you mentioned to me in preparation for this that this is 2009 is the anniversary of Darwin's birth.
Right, it's the 200th anniversary. He was born in 1809. He was born in February, so we're not too far past the actual specific anniversary, but all around, all over, in various universities, research institutes, etc., they're treating the year 2009 as the year of Darwin, much the same as we celebrated the United States' 200th anniversary in 1976. So I think it's appropriate to bring Darwin into the picture.
Absolutely.
Here. Yeah. Now, we mentioned way back when we began in January that no people lived in Antarctica, and the people who have gone since, none of them really live there. They may go for as much as a year to one of these scientific research institutions, but then eventually they circulate back out.
And they were mostly Europeans, too.
Right, right. But now, of course, the biggest year-round contingent is at the American base at the South Pole. So it's time to take a look at these people. And these people at the bottom of the Earth, and we'll say a little bit more about where this is specifically, were discovered, at least by the Western world, when Ferdinand Magellan transited the strait which now bears his name on his trip around the world. Well, he didn't make it. He died in the Philippines. But one of his ships made it. So the first true circumnavigation. And as Magellan worked his way down the coast of South America, he was looking for a way into the Pacific Ocean. And finally, he came upon an opening, and he followed it for close to 30 days. It was very sort of serpentine and very full of obstacles, but that route, which first heads a little bit to the southwest and then heads a little bit to the northwest, a sort of V through all of those islands at the base of South America, of course we know as the Strait of Magellan. And as he passed the largest island, he didn't realize it was an island at the time, but what we know today as the largest island, he saw fires all along the coastline. And Magellan named this coastline Tierra del Fuego, the land of fire, as it is known still today. We still refer to that island as Tierra del Fuego. Now, he was in a hurry to get to the Pacific. He had no time to investigate. He really paid no attention to it other than it was just one more obstacle to get past. But after that, everyone who transited the straits, Francis Drake, etc., Captain Cook, made some note of the savages that they found. That was always the word that was used, the savages who lived there. And probably the most important voyages were those made by Captain Cook, certainly in terms of world exploration. They were the most. He made 3 voyages from 1768 to 1778, and he brought the Fuegians, as he called them, the Fuegians, hard word to pronounce, to the attention of the English and the rest of the European world. Now, Fuegians is the Anglicization, if you will, of those who live in Tierra del Fuego. Oh. Therefore, the strange pronunciation rhymes with wage, page, sage, etc., and spelled F-U-E-G-I-A-N-S. Very often mispronounced, including by me, as Fujians, because it's easier to say. But really, the correct pronunciation is Fuegians, the people who live in Tierra del Fuego. So it's really taken directly from the Spanish. Now, let's jump quickly to Darwin. I said he was born in 1809. And in December of 1831, when he was 22 years old, he set sail with Captain Robert Fitzroy on the ship known as the Beagle on the voyage that eventually resulted in the origin of the species.
Really?
Yeah. I want to emphasize his age.
Yeah,
because
I have no idea.
It means that in the 5 years that the ship was at sea, all of the research, all of the sort of intellectual seeds were planted, which led to origin of the species. This was all done in his early 20s.
My goodness.
And when I read from various passages of his memoir, his log, really, of the voyage of the Beagle, you have to remember this is a 22 or a 23-year-old speaking.
I had no idea. That's not commonly talked about.
No, it's not appreciated. And, of course, partially because the origin of the species was decades in gestation.
Right.
And when it was finally published, and you get these pictures of Darwin, not an old man, but
in his 40s.
But, he's in his 50s,
He's in his 50s by then.
And, with his beard and looking very sage and very settled, et cetera. But all of this began, the work, the famous work on the finches and the Galapagos, all when he was in his early 20s.
Amazing.
Okay. Now, during the southern summer of 1832 to 33, the Beagle, the ship, was in the Straits. And Darwin devoted a whole chapter of his book called The Voyage of the Beagle to his encounters with the Fuegians. Now, let's just take a moment to sketch who these people were. First of all, they were, of course, native people, and they were the ones who lived the farthest south of all the people in the world. Not the farthest north in comparative terms, but the farthest south. Their only competitors were the Polynesian Maori who lived on the south island of what is today New Zealand.
Interesting.
And those people lived at about 47 degrees south, the Maori. That was the farthest south they got. The Fuegians lived on either side of 54 degrees south. So they were about 400 to 500 miles farther south than their only competitors for the record of living farthest south. So that made them a distinct people in a number of ways, including the harshness of the climate in which they live. Now, they're always referred to by Darwin and others of the time as Fuegians, not differentiated between the different groups. But they were actually made up of several groups. The most important of the coastal peoples were ones we know as the Yagan, the Chono, and the Yalakaluf. They lived on the coast. They're the ones who lit the fires, which gave the place the name Tierra del Fuego.
These groups, how do they self-identify by some title that they...
We should think of them in tribal terms.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So these are tribal
terms. These are English?
Yes. These are English words taken from their... from their language.
So they do self-identify as a tribe with some kind of an identification.
Absolutely.
And would that be true, generally speaking?
Yes. Absolutely.
I've always been curious about
that. No, this would be true, obviously, of the Native Americans in the United what's now the United States. And also, there were linguistic differences between the languages that they spoke, including, and I can't say this from memory, there were several of the groups that didn't belong to the same language group. Well, at least they were not mutually comprehensible among themselves.
Okay,
so these were tribes.
tribes, and say, given these three tribes, there might have been six or more language groups.
Not that many language groups, but that certainly that many dialects. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Now, back to Darwin for a moment. When Captain Fitzroy, who was also a youngster, by the way, when he was in his 20s, he had taken four Fuegians back to England with him. This was a common practice when explorers and military expeditions, etc., went to strange lands. They brought back native peoples. In fact, even Magellan himself tried to take back and was successful. His people were successful in bringing two of the folks they had captured back to Spain with them. Anyway, so they had taken four back. One, and they had taken them as hostages when the Fuegians stole one of the small boats from this earlier trip on the Beagle. And then they got one small boy, and they bought him for a pearl button. In other words, they gave a pearl button to his tribe, and the tribe gave them this boy in return. Now, of these hostages, one died of smallpox in England. Another adult, the only other adult, was named York Minister. That's what the British named him, of course.
Sure.
And they called him York Minister because there was an island that had been named by Captain Cook York Minister Mountain. And since they found and captured this guy near that mountain, they just called him York Minister. They had a girl with them, Fuegia Basket, they named her. Don't ask me why, I don't know. And the young boy they had with them that they bought for the button, they named Jemmy Button because he'd been bought with a button. Now, so these three, York Minister, Fuegia Basket, and Jemmy Button, were with Darwin and Fitzroy when they returned to Tierra del Fuego. So, here's Darwin. He's now just turned 23, and he's met his first Fuegians. They land, and they're approached by the locals. So this is Darwin speaking now, writing. "It was without exception the most curious and interesting spectacle I ever beheld. I could not have believed how wide was the difference between savage and civilized man. It's greater than between a wild and a domesticated animal, inasmuch as in a man there's greater power of improvement. The chief spokesman was old and appeared to be the head of the family. The three others were powerful young men about 6 feet high. The women and children had been sent away. These Fuegians are a very different race from the stunted, miserable wretches further westward, and they seem closely allied to the famous Patagonians of the Strait of Magellan. Their only garment consisted of a mantle made of a guanaco skin. Their own skin is of a dirty, coppery red color." He's obviously talking about Ona in this case, because Ona were inland people, and inland people had guanacos, which are a cameloid, not too dissimilar from a llama, but smaller.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And that was a domesticated animal.
They milk it?
Well, they certainly use the hides, and they certainly use the meat. I don't know if they milk them. But anyway, so the people he's talking about are Onas. He continues, "Their attitudes were abject, and the expression of their countenances distrustful, surprised, and startled. After we presented them with some scarlet cloth, which they immediately tied around their necks, they became good friends. This was shown by the old man patting our breasts, making a chuckling kind of noise, as people do when feeding chickens. The language of these people, according to our notions, scarcely deserves to be called articulate. Captain Cook has compared it to a man clearing his throat, but certainly no European ever cleared his throat with so many hoarse, guttural, and clicking sounds."
That's interesting. It reminds me of, and I've not heard a lot, but I've heard that the Chinese use a clicking, guttural language. I'm just curious.
Yes, well, Chinese is a tonal language, and I have no idea whether these were tonal languages.
Yeah.
For reasons which will become a little clearer.
Okay.
Not too much was ever really learned about them. The Fuegian wigwam, this is Darwin again, resembles in size and dimensions a haycock. It merely consists of a few broken branches stuck in the ground, very imperfectly thatched on one side with a few tufts of grass. The whole cannot be the work of an hour. It's only used for a few days. At Gory Roads, I saw a place where one of these naked men had slept, which absolutely offered no more cover than the nest of a hare. I should say, Darwin may mention it later on, that all of these people were nomadic. Mm-hmm. They had nothing that we would consider, or they would consider, in fact, permanent settlements. They were hunter-gatherers, and so they followed the food.
Yep.
Yeah. They pull alongside a canoe, and this is what Darwin has to say. These Fuegians in the canoe were quite naked, and even one full-grown woman was absolutely so. It was raining heavily, and the fresh water, together with the spray, trickled down her body. In another harbor, not far distant, a woman who was suckling a recently born child came one day alongside the vessel and remained there out of mere curiosity, while the sleet fell and thawed on her naked bosom and on the skin of her naked baby. These poor wretches were stunted in their growth, their hideous faces bedaubed with white paint, their skins filthy and greasy, their hair entangled, their voices discordant, and their gestures violent. Viewing such men, one can hardly make oneself believe that they're fellow creatures and inhabitants of the same world. It's a common subject of conjecture what pleasure in life some of the lower animals can enjoy. How much more reasonably the same question may be asked with respect to these barbarians. At night, five or six human beings, naked and scarcely protected from the wind and rain of this tempestuous climate, sleep on the wet ground, coiled up like animals. Whenever it's low water, winter or summer, night or day, they must rise to pick shellfish from the rocks. The women either dive to collect sea eggs, I'm not quite sure what he's referring to there, or sit patiently in their canoes and with a baited hairline without any hook, jerk out little fish. If a seal is killed or the floating carcass of a putrid whale is discovered, it's a feast, and such miserable food is assisted by a few tasteless berries and fungi. It's clear that he regarded them as, if at best, a step above animals. And although I have never seen these scenes myself, I've certainly seen the climate and the location. And the idea that people went about naked in that climate and in these circumstances, dove into the water, hunted, in the water, is almost beyond imagining. What he doesn't mention, and which was discovered later, is that this, what he calls the grease, is the fat or the oil of sea mammals, which they rubbed on their body and which actually gives a very substantial protection against hypothermia and, against the weather. It doesn't allow, it does protect the skin. In this chapter that we're talking about, this chapter 10 of The Voyage of the Beagle, he has a section on cannibalism among these people, which I am going to spare you because this is our strange and wonderful world. It's not supposed to be a catalog of horrors. But it does seem that, yes, human flesh was consumed, and on two occasions. One is when enemies had been captured at times, parts of their bodies were consumed. And there was, by the way, a substantial amount of warfare. These people fought each other all the time. Mm-hmm. They did have bows and arrows, and they had spears. And so there was a lot of killing going on.
Right.
The other
would that part of that have been competition for food sources, or is it hard
again,
to tell?
The anthropological literature on these people is extremely thin, but probably yes, competition for turf, because turf meant food sources, because rookeries were in specific places, tidal areas were in specific places.
Right.
And since they weren't cultivating or changing the landscape in any way, what you wanted was to establish yourself where you were closest to the food. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And while it's possible that there were other food sources, those were the ones that had been mapped and used.
Yes,
and
basically we're talking
through.
About the coastal people.
Right.
And so they were living off the sea.
Right.
Yeah.
And did they move by
They moved by canoe.
Boat? Yeah.
Yeah, they moved by canoe.
Not that different than our people's.
And the canoes were basically, the skin of the canoes were basically seal skin and things like that. They were not, they didn't have sources of wood or the tools to work, wood. Mm-hmm. The other kinds of persons or occasions on which persons were eaten was when famine was upon, real famine was upon them. And then they killed and ate old women. Elderly women. And Darwin asked a local boy why they killed the women, not their dogs, because they had domesticated wild dogs there. And the boy replied, this is a quote, "Doggies catch otters, old women no." So the doggies were worth more than the old women.
Now I would have made a tasty meal.
But you're not an old woman.
Not yet.
Now, early in this chapter, fairly early in the chapter, Darwin introduces these three Fuegians whom they brought with them from England. And here's how he describes them. And it's very interesting because, remember, these three Fuegians have been in England for 3 years. So they are very different people than they were when Fitzroy took them.
I've been curious about them.
Yeah. So here's what Darwin says. "York Minister was a full-grown, short, thick, powerful man. His disposition was reserved, taciturn, morose, and when excited, violently passionate. His affections were very strong toward a few friends on board, his intellect good. Jemmy Button," remember that's the boy, "was a universal favorite, but likewise passionate. The expression of his face at once showed his nice disposition. He was merry and often laughed, and was remarkably sympathetic with anyone in pain when the water was rough. I was often a little seasick, and he used to come to me and say in a plaintive voice, 'Poor, poor fellow!' But the notion, after his aquatic life, of a man being seasick was too ludicrous, and he was generally obliged to turn on one side and hide a smile or laugh, and then he would turn and repeat his, 'Poor, poor fellow!' Jemmy was short, thick, and fat, but vain of his personal appearance. He used always to wear gloves. His hair was neatly cut. He was distressed if his well-polished shoes were dirty. It seems yet wonderful to me, when I think over all his many good qualities, that he should have been of the same race and doubtless partaken of the same character with the miserable, degraded savages whom we first met here. Lastly, Fuegia Basket was a nice, modest, reserved young girl in a rather pleasing but sometimes sullen expression. Very quick in learning anything, especially languages. This she showed in picking up some Portuguese and Spanish when left on shore for only a short time at Rio de Janeiro or Montevideo, and in her knowledge of English. York Minister was very jealous of any attention paid to her, for it was clear he determined to marry her as soon as they were settled ashore." Now, the striking thing about this passage is that Darwin speaks or sort of characterizes these people as if they were perfectly ordinary people. He could have written the same thing about three Europeans.
Yeah, exactly.
And in it he reveals very clearly, although he never makes this totally explicit, that he thinks the problem with these people is a cultural problem.
You're right.
He doesn't treat it in racial terms.
Right.
He was not a racist. He saw this culture. He was a... he abhorred what he saw. It was horrid. He couldn't believe it. And yet, 3 years in England transformed these into these folks into perfectly acceptable, reasonable, and even attractive human beings.
Right.
Now, so Captain Fitzroy wants to return York Minister Jemmy Button and Fuegia Basket to their own people. And there are, in this chapter, quite a few different adventures as they try and find the people, and they land, and they try and find out where the people are, etc. Finally, they come to a bay, and they're able to make contact with Jemmy's tribe, Jemmy
Button. Now, how long have they been gone? Can you help?
3 years.
3 years, okay.
They've been away 3 years.
Okay, not a terribly long time.
So, here's Darwin again talking about this first contact with Jemmy's people. "The next morning, after our arrival, the Fuegians began to pour in, and Jemmy's mother and brothers arrived. Jemmy recognized the stentorian voice of one of his brothers at a prodigious distance. The meeting was less interesting than that between a horse turned out into a field when he joins an old companion. There was no demonstration of affection. They simply stared for a short time at each other, and the mother immediately went to look after her canoe. We heard, however, through York, that the mother had been inconsolable for the loss of Jemmy and had searched everywhere for him, thinking that he might have been left after having been taken in the boat. The women took much notice of and were very kind to Fuegia. We had already perceived that Jemmy had almost forgotten his own language. I should think there was scarcely another human being with so small a stock of language, for his English was very imperfect. It was laughable, but almost pitiable, to hear him speak to his wild brother in English and ask him in Spanish, "No sabe? No sabe?" Which is to say, "Don't you understand?" whether or not he didn't understand, whether or not he understood him. Everything went on peaceably during the three next days while the gardens were digging and wigwams building. We estimated the number of natives at about 120. The women worked hard while the men lounged about all day, watching us. They asked for everything they saw and stole what they could. Okay, so later, so they leave them, the three there. Later, Fitzroy and Darwin return, meeting up again with Jemmy, who'd given many of his possessions and the crew's gifts to his family. So Jemmy left with quite a few material goods. They put him ashore. He had his own possession and gifts. And here's what Darwin then sees happens to these possessions. Darwin again. Jemmy's relatives had been so vain and foolish that they had showed to strangers their plunder and their manner of obtaining it. It was quite melancholy leaving the three Fuegians with their savage countrymen, but it was a great comfort that they had no personal fears. York, being a powerful, resolute man, was pretty sure to get on well, together with his wife Fuegia. Poor Jemmy looked rather disconsolate, and would then, I have little doubt, have been glad to have returned with us. His own brother had stolen many things from him, and he remarked, this is Jemmy, "What fashion call that?" He abused his countrymen. "All bad men. No sabe nothing." And though I never heard him swear before, "Damned fools!" Our three Fuegians, though they had been only 3 years with civilized men, would, I am sure, have been glad to have retained their new habits. But this was obviously impossible. I fear it is more than doubtful whether their visit will have been any use to them. He's speaking, of course, of the visit to England. Now, it's March 83, and the Beagle is on its way out of the Strait of Magellan. Later, because they found a new way out, they called it the Beagle Channel. They're about to leave Tierra del Fuego. Darwin has just turned 24. They turn westward to clear the strait and head up the coast of Chile. They spot a canoe approaching their anchorage. Here's Darwin again. Soon a canoe with a little flag flying was seen approaching, with one of the men in, washing the paint off his face. This man was poor Jemmy, now a thin, haggard savage, with long, disordered hair and naked except a bit of blanket about his waist. We did not recognize him till he was close up, for he was ashamed of himself and turned his back to the ship. We had left him plump, fat, clean, and well-dressed. I never saw so complete and grievous a change. As soon, however, as he was clothed and the first flurry was over, things wore a good appearance. He dined with Captain Fitzroy, ate his dinner as tidily as formerly. He told us that he had too much, meaning enough, to eat, that he was not cold, that his relations were very good people, and that he did not wish to go back to England. In the evening, we found out the cause of this great change in Jemmy's feelings in the arrival of his young and nice-looking wife. With his usual good feeling, he brought two beautiful otter skins for two of his best friends. These are best friends on the ship. Mm-hmm. And some spearheads and arrows made with his own hands for the captain. He said he had built a canoe for himself, and he boasted that he could talk a little of his own language. But it is a most singular fact that he appears to have taught all of his tribe some English. An old man spontaneously announced, "Jemmy Button's wife." Jemmy had lost all his property. He told us that York Minister had built a large canoe and with his wife, Fuegia, had taken several months since gone to his own country. taken farewell by an act of consummate villainy. He persuaded Jemmy and his mother to come with him, and then on the way deserted them by night, stealing every article of their property. Jemmy went to sleep on shore, and in the morning returned, remained on board till the ship got underway, which frightened his wife, who continued crying violently till he got into his canoe. He returned loaded with valuable property. Every soul on board was heartily sorry to shake hands with him for the last time. I do not now doubt that he will be as happy as, perhaps happier than, if he had never left his own country. Now, here comes Darwin revealing a great deal about himself, because as the chapter ends, Darwin lets his thoughts run free, and he muses on the general condition of the Fuegians, which, as I've already mentioned, he views as a cultural condition, not as a racial determination, or determined by race. And particularly he muses on their relation to the land. And this is a theme which runs through all of Darwin's work, of course, the relationship of living creatures to the land. The land meaning the environment, in this case, right. The larger environment. And how that environment shapes who they are and what they are and how they behave and et cetera.
And how they evolve.
And we see him here. Remember, he's just still a puppy in his early 20s. Displaying what I call his comparison gene. Because if there's any single, if you will, methodology that characterizes Darwin's work, it's the fact that he'd see an X, and then he'd see an X plus, and he'd ask, why is this an X plus, and this thing, whether it's a plant or an animal or a bird or whatever, only an X? What conditions have led them to differentiate the one from the other? So he's constantly comparing. And it was the beaks of the finches, remember, that he brought back as dead birds, of course, from the Galapagos, that led him to the speculative train, which led him eventually to the origin of the species. Mm-hmm. So he's a comparative guy.
Right.
And here he is. And you can see the germ of that habit here. This is Darwin again writing. The habitable land is reduced to the stones on the beach. In search of food, they're compelled unceasingly to wander from spot to spot. And so steep is the coast that they can only move about in their wretched canoes. They cannot know the feeling of having a home, and still less that of domestic affection. For the husband is to the wife a brutal master, to a laborious slave. Fagan's footnote to this. Although Darwin doesn't mention it, one of the women's roles here was to basically take care of the canoes. The canoes couldn't, as a rule, be pulled up on these rocky shores, the big tidal sweep there. So the canoes were anchored out, mm-hmm. and they were anchored to kelp. They were tied to kelp. They didn't have anchors as we understand them. And fires were kept in the canoe because they took their fire with them from
place
to place, because you, in this climate, you can't be sure that you're going to be able to start another fire. So the women tended the fire on beds of moss and things like that in canoes. They paddled the canoes out. They tied them to the kelp. The fire had already been brought ashore. Then they jumped in the water and they swam to shore. That was one of their jobs. So Darwin had evidently, you know, seen much of this, and the husbands were sort of layabouts, and the women did the hard and dangerous work. He continues, how little can the higher powers of the mind be brought into play? What is there for imagination to picture, for reason to compare, for judgment to decide upon? To knock a limpet from the rock does not require even cunning, that lowest power of the mind. Their skill in some respects may be compared to the instinct of animals, for it's not improved by experience. The canoe, their most ingenious work, poor as it is, has remained the same as we know from Drake for the last 250 years. While beholding these savages, one asks, whence have they come? What could have tempted? Or what change compelled a tribe of men to leave the fine regions of the north, to travel down the Cordillera, the mountain range, or backbone of America, to invent and build canoes which are not used by the tribes of Chile, Peru, and Brazil, and then to enter on one of the most inhospitable countries within the limits of the globe? Although such reflections must at first seize on the mind, yet we may feel sure that they're partly erroneous. There's no reason to believe that the Fuegians decrease in number. Therefore, we must suppose that they enjoy a sufficient share of happiness, of whatever kind it may be, to render life worth having. Nature, by making habit omnipotent and its effects hereditary, has fitted the Fuegian to the climate and productions of his miserable country.
That's an interesting observation, somewhat changed from his initial observation of the savage, awful nature. I mean, he talks
Are made by the conditions in which they live.
Right. Yeah. And he talks about enjoying a sufficient share of happiness.
Yeah.
Which is different.
Yeah,
it just fascinates me, the whole... And this is not unlike what the earlier explorers, how they described the Native Americans in North America, here in this country. I mean, there's a pattern there for certain of comparison to a European culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I look around now where the European culture has led us, I mean, including ourselves, into the potential destruction of the globe... It causes one to wonder about the perception of what has a meaning and value in terms of improvement, quote.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, although I must say, sort of not in Darwin's defense, but in sort of a consonance with him, having been in those regions, it is, I mean, they're spectacularly beautiful. Mm-hmm. But it's also, when you think about what it took to live down there, you marvel that, why in heaven's name did they ever get down there?
And why did they stay?
Yeah, and why they stay. Whereas up north, but of course the same thing can be asked about the extreme northern Eskimo, you know, as well.
Right, exactly.
Even the Laplanders.
They seem to have adapted somewhat more comfortable, as we know it,
lifestyle
in the north?
There's no comparison.
Right.
No, the adaptation of the northern native peoples is brilliant.
Right.
And it took someone like Amundsen and others to see that it was a brilliant adaptation and that the English, could learn from the Darwin in his wildest moments, full of rum, never would have said something like, we have much to learn from the Fuegians.
Right,
he would have said, we have nothing to learn from them.
Right.
They can only learn from us.
Exactly.
It's a one-way street.
Yeah, exactly.
Us to them.
And of course, that was our perception of the native peoples living here. I mean, it still is, actually, in a lot of ways.
Yes, although there is this backflow of, let's call it, Native American wisdom and religion and et cetera, harmony with the land, et cetera, backflowing now into the culture. Never were the Fuegians capable of producing that civilization, that culture, was not capable of producing a backflow into Western culture.
Right.
And in that they were, that was rather unusual.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no,
rather
I see
unusual.
That. Now, you're probably going to get to it, but do these people still exist?
Yeah. Well,
don't get ahead of the story, girl. Okay.
We're almost there.
Okay.
Okay. Here comes Darwin's last words, and this is worth listening to carefully, because he opens a new theme. Here's Darwin. The perfect equality among the individuals composing the Fuegian tribes must for a long time retard their civilization. Note, perfect equality retards civilization. Darwin continues, as we see those animals whose instinct compels them to live in society and obey a chief are most capable of improvement, so it is with the races of mankind. Whether we look at it as a cause or a consequence, the more civilized always have the most artificial governments. For instance, the inhabitants of Tahiti, who when first discovered were governed by hereditary kings, had arrived at a far higher grade than another branch of the same people, the New Zealanders. He's referring, of course, to the Maori, who, although benefited by being compelled to turn their attention to agriculture, were republicans in the most absolute sense. Here he's using the word republicans as almost a synonym for egalitarians, without hierarchical forms of government is what he really means. In Tierra del Fuego, until some chief shall arise with power sufficient to secure any acquired advantage, such as the domesticated animals, it seems scarcely possible that the political state of the country can be improved. At present, even a piece of cloth given to one is torn into shreds and distributed, and no one individual becomes richer than another. On the other hand, it's difficult to understand how a chief can arise till there is property of some sort by which he might manifest his superiority and increase his power. So what he's saying is really very interesting, and in a way very, very Western, that you need inequality, you need hierarchy, you need property concentrated in some hands in order to generate a dynamic that is a civilizing and an accumulating dynamic. He's really talking about, if you will, to some extent, the ideological bases of capitalism,
right.
Although he doesn't use that language
right.
at all.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what he's talking about.
Yep.
Oh, and he ends the chapter saying this, and here comes a kicker. I believe in this extreme part of South America, man exists in a lower state of improvement than in any other part of the world. The South Sea Islanders of the two races inhabiting the Pacific are comparatively civilized. The Eskimo in his subterranean hut enjoys some of the comforts of life, and in his canoe, when fully equipped, manifests much skill. The Australian, he's talking about the Aborigines,
mm-hmm.
So let's just say, the Aborigines, in the simplicity of the arts of life, come nearest the Fuegian. He, the Aborigine, can, however, boast of his boomerang, his spear and throwing stick, his method of climbing trees, of tracking animals, and of hunting. Although the Australian may be superior in acquirements, it by no means follows that he is likewise superior in mental capacity. Indeed, From what I saw of the Fuegians when on board, and from what I have read of the Australians, I should think the case was exactly the reverse.
Interesting.
Yeah. So he continues to support the notion that these are bright, capable folks with all kinds of potential, but they are damned by the place they live.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Interesting. And the Maoris, I assume he's talking about the Maoris.
Yes.
Have less mental capacity.
Yeah. Well, he's talking in this case about the Aborigines.
The Aborigines. And,
yeah, not the Maori.
Because okay.
The Aborigines are not Polynesian people,
right,
whereas
right.
the Maoris are. So, Carol, you asked earlier, what happened to the Fuegians?
Okay, here we go, huh?
Well, I've been there and there ain't none.
Okay.
First, let's just take a look, though, at what happened to Darwin's and Fitz. Roy's Fuegians. York Minister was killed in retaliation for having killed another Fuegian.
Hmm.
Jimmy Button led a massacre of English missionaries that tried to settle on his land.
Mm-hmm.
So Jimmy defended his turf. Fuegia Basket lived to her 60s and had at least one or two more Fuegian husbands. The English finally established a mission in the 1860s, so we're now almost three decades after Darwin, okay, in the 1860s, followed by Argentines and Chileans who came down and settled, established missions, and in fact tried to farm some of the inland, well, to raise sheep. It was the beginning of the end. No longer did the Fuegians slather themselves with seal oil, because the missionaries dressed them up in Western clothing. Measles, smallpox, TB, and other diseases spread through the population, spread like wildfire. Mm. There are stories that a crew would bring measles, to which they were largely immune, into a Fuegian settlement, and within 6 days, most of the people had died of measles. Because measles is a deadly disease,
yeah.
And then you have no immunity to you at all. By the 1930s, only a few dozen remained alive. And in 1999, just at the turn of the century, the last full-blooded Fuegian died.
That's a really tragic story.
It's a tremendously tragic story.
There's a deep sadness about what European, I mean, I'm talking about my ancestors, so I'm not talking about the nation-state European, I'm talking about the cultural context, have done across the planet to Indigenous peoples.
Yeah. And here it was done, one could say, I mean, I don't agree with the motives of the missionaries, but that's not important. But the motives were not to steal their property or their lands. The mm-hmm. motive, of course, was to Christianize. Right. And what they did was they killed them.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Or to culturize them in some
yeah,
way.
Yeah, that's right.
Prove,
so
quote,
they were killed. They were killed by indirection because mm-hmm. these people had been so isolated for so long, well, since the beginning of their existence, that the European diseases were not only fatal, but fatal with a kind of veracity. You know, they just these diseases devoured them in a very short period of time.
Right.
Yeah. Now, in that area, you will still occasionally see a trace of Fuegian, you know, in a face or in skin color or something like that. But you won't see any of these people or any of their artifacts.
Culture.
And
right.
basically, with all the other places that anthropologists had to go and all the other interesting things and all the relations between anthropologists and colonial expansion mm-hmm. and colonies and all of this kind of stuff, these folks were very low on the list.
Oh,
I
sure.
mean, that was the last place anyone would go to write a doctoral dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were a few, but we know precious little about them. Precious
right.
little about them.
Well, and it does sound, I mean, there's no mention of any kind of artistic or written symbolism.
No.
Or
they
any
left nothing in the way of what we would consider cultural artifacts.
Right.
And I mean, in so many other places, even in places that at first look unpromising, they discover these unbelievable woven textiles, you know, or this or that. But there's no evidence that, for instance, even the guanaco, which produces a very nice wool, that this wool was ever used, this fleece
mm-hmm.
was ever used in, let's say, in any kind of artisanal manufacturing.
Right.
You skin the beast and you threw the,
right.
you know, the beast's hide over your shoulders
right.
and that was it.
Yeah. It occurred to me that the woman they captured, whose name was Basket, I wondered if that there wasn't some weaving involved, but there's no mention of that anywhere.
No, and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah,
Now, they did have containers of various sorts, but the ones that I've read about are all natural, like the bladder of a sea otter to carry fresh water in, you know, that
right.
kind of
right.
thing. Not a manufactured article, not
right,
of clay, not of reeds and anything like that.
I mean, they survived there for many generations.
Hand to mouth, quite literally.
Yeah. The other thing that occurred to me is when the other man, Minister York. York Minister. He was put to death because he killed one of his countrymen, and so there were rules around cannibalism, and there must have been some ritual.
Yeah, I don't know the circumstances of his death, except that since the various tribes were warring with each other almost constantly,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the the story that it was in retaliation for something he did is probably accurate.
Yeah. No, I would think so too.
As far as I know, they did not have alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm, that's
because
no
they didn't have the grain source in order to produce
for fermentation.
Something like that. Yeah,
and apparently they weren't introduced by the colonial powers that came in because there's no mention of that.
No.
Huh. Really fascinating. It's just
it is a sad story, but I chose to tell it. Not because I want to tell a lot of sad stories.
No, not
area,
at all.
But
it's fascinating.
Because it does. Darwin gives us a lever. Well, the experience gives us a window into Darwin,
mm-hmm.
and Darwin gives us a window into the ideology, the beliefs, the science, if you will, of the time. So it's useful in that way. It goes both directions.
Very much so.
Yeah.
That's I can definitely see why you included so many of Darwin's writings himself. It's still hard to imagine him being this young man.
This puppy.
Who's actually, projecting his own cultural biases and beliefs.
Well, of course. I mean, of course we all do.
Exactly. But seemingly without conscious awareness of that at this point in his life.
No, I would say that's right. Although, he was, by the way, when he started this trip, he was quite religious. Mm-hmm. Fitzroy was very religious, and that meant, of course, that you gave credence, literal credence, to the Book of Genesis. So Darwin had that legacy, if you will, mm-hmm. to shuffle off. I mean, mm-hmm. This was transformatory, not only in terms of his ideas about the origins of the species, but about the place that religion mm-hmm. played in shaping our ideas about how the world came to be and what the world is. He had even something approaching a falling out with Fitzroy later, with whom he was very close. Fitzroy was only about 5 years older than Darwin, five or six. He had a falling out with him because Fitzroy simply couldn't accept, along with a lot of other people, couldn't accept Darwin's view of how the world worked.
Yeah. Right. Because he was too rooted in the species.
That's right. He was too rooted in conventional Christian beliefs of the time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ideology, whatever language you choose. Well, what another wonderful story in this Strange and Wonderful World series. Just really fascinating, very timely, since we're only a few months past Darwin's 200th birthday.
Yeah.
And to see into the mind of this young man and his observations of these fascinating peoples.
Well, what we're going to do next time, by the way, Carol,
okay,
we're going to make a jump.
Okay.
And next time, I'm going to do something about man in the sea, humankind in the sea. And it'll probably take two sessions to get through it all. But as we move in the direction of the Pacific Ocean, which was pretty much the birthplace of mankind mm-hmm. and womankind, attempting to jump into the sea and pretend that they were marine mammals, which is to say, take a deep breath, go down, see what was down there, pick some of the treasures of the sea off the sea floor, etc. I want to talk about diving because it's woven through the history of the Pacific in Polynesia, in Japan, in some very, very important ways, and a subject that's fascinated me for well over half a century. So we'll get wet, so to speak, in the Pacific.
Well,
we couldn't really get wet in Antarctica. It's too bloody cold.
Although these women dove down.
Oh.
So that's a good jumping off place from Antarctica into warmer water.
Warmer
water. We can even imagine ourselves, perhaps.
Right.
Well, and I look forward to that. And you are listening to KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And this is Lopez Community Radio. And signing off, this is Carol Steckler. And this has been another adventure in this strange and wonderful world with Richard Fagan. And have a lovely day.